Hello, and welcome to Intersections, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. I'm your host, Adriana Pita. Today, we're here to discuss issues of financial inclusion. And with me are Daryl West, who's the Vice President and Director of Governance Studies, also co-author of the latest edition of the Financial and Digital Inclusion Project Report. Also with us today is Camille Bousette, who is a Senior Fellow and Director of our Race, Prosperity, and Inclusion Initiative. Camille came to Brookings from the Consultative Group to Assist the Poor and also previously headed the Office of Financial Education at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Thank you both very much for being here today.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
So, Daryl, I wanted to start with you first. This is the third edition of this Financial and Digital Inclusion Report that you've worked on with your co-authors, John Villasenor and Robin Lewis. I wanted to ask you, in your time working on this, why did you find it so important to tie that financial and digital inclusion aspects together? And how did you choose the countries that you chose to look at?
I mean, we're interested in the topic of financial inclusion just because when you look around the world, there are many people who do not have access to traditional financial services. So they don't have access to banks. And so if they want to start businesses, it's a problem. Just in terms of getting consumer credit, it's an issue. So there are countries that are experimenting with mobile money. Mm-hmm. And with digital financial services as a means to provide financial services to people outside of traditional banks. So what our report has done over the last 3 years is to track what various countries around the world are doing. This year, we're focusing on 26 different nations, mostly in the developing world. And each year, we have tracked what kind of progress they're making. We look at the regulatory environment, mobile capacity, how committed the country is to a financial inclusion strategy, and how much progress they've made in actually adopting various mobile money practices.
Okay. And now that we've been going for about 3 years, are you starting to notice any sort of emerging trends, or have there been any findings that have started to surprise you?
There are some countries that are doing a really good job of this. For example, I think every year in which we've done the study, Kenya has been a top-performing country. Kenya is a country that is a real innovator in terms of mobile money. Mm-hmm. They have a problem in their country of banks not providing inexpensive options for poor people. Mm-hmm. And so mobile money has become a way for people who are underserved by the traditional banks to gain access to financial services. So they have been a real leader in that regard.
So you broke the question of financial inclusion, you broke it down into sort of four components that you looked at for all these 26 countries. It was the question of country commitment, mobile capacity, the regulatory environment, and how much those countries had adopted different traditional and digital financial services. How do you go about measuring some of those things?
We have about 36 different indicators for those four dimensions, so we look at a variety of things. The point of the study is to look at what the financial inclusion strategy is in a particular country, how well they're executing that strategy, and then what are the things they need to try and promote greater financial inclusion. So, for example, mobile capacity is a factor that we look at, and that includes people having access to mobile networks, the degree of mobile penetration within a particular country. The regulatory environment is a key part of the degree to which new services can come to the marketplace. So we look at how a country regulates this and does it promote more opportunities for businesses to start. So we looked at a variety of indicators, but all designed to measure various aspects of financial inclusion.
And now with these countries that you're studying, how do you work with them in terms of getting the data? Do you work with their official ministries of finance? Are there non-governmental organizations who do this kind of work? And then also, how do you work with them afterward in terms of giving them your findings and making any recommendations?
We get information from a variety of different sources, but what we've done with the individual countries is once we've compiled the information, we check with experts within each country just to make sure what we're doing is moving in the right direction, the mm-hmm. information is accurate. It's a fast-moving space, and so we want to make sure that we're up to date, that we've captured all of the latest developments over the course of the last year. So we've had a lot of engagement with people in the countries, both in terms of formulating the research and putting together our report. And then after the report comes out, we always get a lot of feedback. The top-performing countries, of course, love our study because they look good in the process. But some of the countries that don't perform so well, they would like advice on how they can do better. So we feel like our report has had a real impact in shaping how various governments are thinking about financial inclusion, and we hope that we're encouraging them to move closer and closer to that goal.
What would you say were some of the key findings for this year's report?
The thing that was distinctive about this year's report, in addition to just kind of tracking progress towards financial inclusion, is we wanted to look at things like cybersecurity and consumer protection, because mm-hmm. we know that in a lot of countries, cash is still the dominant means by which people engage in financial transactions. So mm-hmm. moving people into a mobile money world and or a digital financial services world requires a lot of trust on the part of the consumer. Like, they have to trust that when they set up a digital account for financial services that, you know, their account's not going to be hacked, that somebody's not going to steal their personal information. So the cybersecurity component was new this year, and you know, we want countries to take that element very seriously because it's really important to consumer trust and confidence in the transaction. And then the other new element was taking seriously the idea of a consumer protection, because the whole point of this is to help the consumers. And so we want countries to engage in various practices that help the consumers, that protect their privacy. There's a financial literacy aspect in a lot of countries that governments as well as NGOs and people in the private sector need to be helping to educate their people on the benefits of mobile money and digital mm-hmm. financial services. So we encourage countries to do a better job on that as well.
All right. Camille, I'd like to draw you in at this point now, because the issue of financial inclusion is, of course, important to more than just the developing world. It's very much an issue here in the U.S. as well as in other countries in the developed world. I'm wondering if you can talk to us a little bit about how some of those issues differ. What are the issues that the U.S. is looking at in terms of financial inclusion?
Sure. Happy to chat about that. But I wanted to say before we talk about those issues that the report that Daryl, John, and Robin have issued in previous editions has been really well received, both by practitioners and regulators. And I think it's a great way to look at all the countries in a really comprehensive way and systematically compare them. So I think mm-hmm. it's been very valuable from that perspective. With respect to the U.S., you know, we have a pretty significant underbanked and unbanked problem here. So about 10 million households do not have bank accounts mm-hmm. in the U.S., and about 25 million households are underbanked, meaning they only use one service and don't really have access to other services. That's actually very significant. And it's significant also because of the profile of people who are in those groups of mm-hmm. unbanked and underbanked. Those tend to be low-income people and people in communities of color. Mm-hmm. And typically in areas where the only financial service might be a pawnbroker or a payday lender. And so you are talking about folks who really are very limited in their opportunities to utilize a formal financial system. And the reason we care about that is that that can be very detrimental to economic mobility and generally participating in the economy.
In your time at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, what was the role of that bureau, and particularly your Office of Financial Education, in dealing with some of these issues?
So, of course, the bureau is very much focused on consumer protection issues and has a very broad authority over a range of financial services and products. It does also look at the kinds of alternative financial products that underbanked and unbanked people and families and households tend to use, and does regulate in those areas. So prepaid cards and predatory lending of all sorts, payday lending, those are areas in which it does have jurisdiction. My Office of Financial Education had actually a broader authority than the Bureau itself mm-hmm. and able to look at a range of other kinds of products, insurance products, auto loan products, et cetera, that were not necessarily in the jurisdiction of the Bureau. And so in that capacity, we really had an opportunity and a responsibility to look at unbanked and underbanked issues and how we can support people who are not necessarily in the formal financial system with respect to information that will help them avoid abusive practices, as well as help them understand and evaluate a range of products and services that might be offered to them.
In terms of coming up with policies to address these issues, what would you say is the role of, there's the executive branch agencies, the role of Congress, the role of state-level agencies? What are some of the different breakdowns in terms of who can help starting to tackle some of these issues?
Well, certainly consumer protection is handled across the board by a variety of agencies. So certainly you have the Bureau that we just talked about. You have state agencies and municipal agencies that are really involved in consumer protection. Mm-hmm. With respect to advancing the opportunities for inclusion in the formal financial services, area. Actually, a lot of municipalities have been taking a lead on that. There's an organization called the Cities for Financial Empowerment that have grown from initially a set of cities that were really focused on bringing in underbanked into formal financial institutions, and that was called the Bank On movement. And then it moved into financial empowerment, and those cities have been very active in finding different ways in which low-income and poor Americans who are not part of the formal financial system can be included in a very responsible way.
I was wondering, both within the U.S., then also between the countries that you're looking at, Daryl, what sort of mechanisms are there for information sharing? You know, one country tries certain type of experiment with mobile money. How can they share what worked and what didn't with other countries who are doing similar things and also within the states?
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of information sharing that takes place. For example, Camille, when she was at the World Bank, where she worked before joining Brookings, the World Bank is great at connecting countries and sharing best practices. So kind of looking at countries like Kenya, and now Mexico is doing a better job in saying, okay, this is what they're doing. Here are possible opportunities for your country. Like if you want to do a better job, provide more financial services to underserved communities, these are particular regulatory steps you can undertake. These are policy measures you can adopt. These are the ways you can encourage new financial service providers to come into the marketplace. So that has been very valuable. We've found countries are very eager to learn from one another. One of the things we've done in each of our reports is we have a very lengthy appendix on individual countries, kind of outlining what are the new developments in those places, what are the new things they're trying that seem to be doing a better job of providing services. We're particularly interested in how technology can empower women and marginalized people in mm-hmm. various countries. And so there are lots of lessons that countries that want to make progress can learn from other places in terms of how to do the best job of that.
Yeah, I would agree with Daryl on that. Certainly, there's a lot of interest in learning from each country, learning from each other. And I remember when I was at CGAP at the World Bank, we would routinely hold convenings where we would get regulators together from, you know, a diverse set of countries and talk about developments in the space, particularly in the mobile money space, but generally in financial inclusion. And those were really well received and very, very popular. And so Daryl's right. I mean, there's a lot of appetite for that kind of cross-learning. And even among, I would say, corporate executives who are interested in this space as well. Here, you know, in the U.S., I think one of the major proponents for that kind of cross-learning has actually in the past been the Department of Treasury. They've done a fairly interesting job of trying to pull together a number of interested actors. So in the corporate space, as well as the nonprofit space and the governmental space, to try to figure out how do we make these opportunities more available. And now the FDIC has been doing quite a bit in that space as well. They put out in a report every few years on the state of the unbanked and the underbanked. And the most recent report came out in 2015, and I expect there'll be another one in about 2018. So there's a lot of interest, I think, in the U.S. I think one of the areas that the report focuses on that I think is of interest across the globe have to do with the issues around cybersecurity and consumer protection. Mm-hmm. And cybersecurity protections here are probably a little bit more advanced than they are in other parts of the globe, particularly in emerging economies. But one of the things I found when I was at CGAP is that there's a lot of interest in consumer protections as new and alternative methods of providing mobile money and other kinds of money to poorer clients emerge. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an area where there's a lot of eagerness to learn not only from the U.S., but the U.K. and other jurisdictions that have a good record on consumer protection. But one of the interesting things, and I think one of the reasons the report is so valuable, is that it shines a light on that. And consumer protections tend to be pretty underdeveloped in a lot of the economies that the report focuses on. And so I think there's a lot of opportunity there.
I wanted to ask about that because, Daryl, you had written in the report that, generally speaking, everyone was basically on board with the economic benefits of expanding financial inclusion. Everyone sort of gets that basic math of the more people involved in the economy, the better it is. But that a lot of these questions, such as consumer protections, the cybersecurity issue, there's a lot of questions about how to balance out some of these issues. And one example of this was your working group had a roundtable earlier this year about cybersecurity issues. And as you alluded to earlier, they talked about the fact that it's really important to deal with issues of cybersecurity because that's really important for making the system work. But there are a lot of concerns about how much do you talk about the fact that cybersecurity is an issue, because will you turn people off from getting involved in this financial system if they go, oh, God, I'm going to get hacked, I'm going to lose all my money? Can you talk a little bit about some of these other issues that have these same sort of sticky balancing points?
Cybersecurity certainly is one of the problems that has slowed progress in this area, in the sense that, especially in the developing world, just building trust in digital services as opposed to cash. Mm-hmm. Because many of these societies are cash-only societies. People feel comfortable when they have the currency in their hands, kind of convincing them that they should put their money someplace and then transfer it digitally is a new concept for them. And so in order for them to want to make use of those types of services, they have to feel very confident. So they have to feel good that their information is not going to get hacked. The other barrier that has been a real problem over the last couple of decades is governments worry about mobile money and digital financial service transactions because, you know, they're concerned about terrorism, they're mm-hmm. concerned about money laundering. They worry that if people are just moving money around kind of independently of banks, that governments will not be able to track the so-called bad actors. Right. And so there needs to be a balance between, obviously, we don't want to promote terrorism, but we want to promote innovative financial services that helped underserved communities get access to money.
Camille, do you have any domestic examples of some of those?
Well, I wanted to chat a little bit about not just the domestic area, but also some other balancing acts, I think, yes. that would complement the list that Daryl just provided. So one of the areas that I think is sort of interesting in this space is, particularly for financial inclusion, is how do you move from offering mobile money to other sorts of services? So when you were talking about people feeling trust in the system and feeling secure about transacting, whenever something goes wrong, right, and that does happen frequently, low bandwidth, things go offline, et cetera, sometimes people don't develop the kind of trust that you need to move from just, you know, transacting on the phone to other kinds of transactions. And so that has tended to be a kind of sticky space in general. And then the other area more generally, which I think in the U.S. might have been solved, but I think in emerging economies still is to be solved, is how do you create a really valid business model around serving poor people? So when you're talking about serving poor people, you know, as Daryl and his co-authors, I think, have emphasized, you're talking about small, frequent transactions. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of financial service providers, not those in mobile money, but otherwise, it's just very hard for them to make money on that level of activity, small, you know, really small amounts, but people are transacting pretty frequently. And so I think a lot of businesses struggle to figure out how to create a business model that really works for them there. And in the U.S., we've had a whole set of financial services, fintech services, mm-hmm. that have emerged that are trying to do that. And some have done that well, and others are a little less consumer friendly and have still managed to, you know, eke out a business model. But I think that still remains an interesting conundrum for the industry.
And if I can add just one point to what Camille was talking about, in the United States, there has been the growth of a lot of new players in the financial services mm-hmm. sector in the United States, and they're trying to reach new types of communities. And in a lot of respects, this is a good development because it creates opportunities for people who don't have access to the traditional banks to get financial services. But at the same time, we do have to worry about some predatory practices that have developed, particularly targeted on low-income communities, like the payday loans, where people get access to money outside of traditional banks, but at very high interest rates. And so it's counterproductive. And so we have to kind of maintain a balance of promoting innovation, developing new types of services, but make sure they're not engaging in predatory practices.
Right. What were some of those successful business models that are seeming to work so far?
Well, I think there's some where particularly prepaid cards are provided that allow customers to have savings accounts as well as to use the card to transact the way you would normally use a debit card, et cetera. So I think those have been a rather successful and generally well received. But again, as Daryl says, you know, there's some companies that will deliver that in a really responsible way, and then there are others that are a little bit more predatory with respect to fees, et cetera. And so I think there have been experiments that have been more responsible and some that have been a little less responsible. And of course, the role of consumer protection agencies is to shine a bright light on those kinds of practices that are abusive and are predatory and make sure to keep those under control.
Talking about experimenting, Daryl, one of the things that was in the report was this idea of creating sandboxes where whether it's businesses or agencies could have room to do different experiments about what works and what doesn't, but while at the same time providing certain protections. Can you talk a little bit about that concept and how do you create a virtual sandbox?
Well, it's a regulatory sandbox in the sense that in some places, government regulations discourage innovation and make it difficult for mobile money providers to come into the marketplace or other types of providers to offer financial services for people outside of banks. And so what we're encouraging countries to think about is what we call a regulatory sandbox, where there can basically, under certain types of controls, companies be given the right to experiment with a careful tracking of what the results are, because we don't want people to get injured in the process or companies to incur unnecessary risk, but kind of free them of some of the more onerous regulations as a way to promote innovation and to encourage experimentation. And so some countries have moved in this direction, and it's a great way to kind of encourage innovation, but in a safer space than just what typically exists in those places.
Okay. Do you have an example that you can cite for us, or you can explain?
Mexico has loosened some of the requirements in recent years, and we notice in comparing Mexico last year versus in the current year report, Mexico has made a lot of progress. So they have experimented. They have made a new commitment in terms of their national financial inclusion strategy. So they're doing a variety of things to try and encourage new types of providers.
If I could just add to that, this space of regulatory sandboxes is actually expanding considerably. And when I was at the CFPB, we actually started one. I think we may have been one of the first. So we had Project Catalyst, which was exactly as Gerald described, which is that you allow companies to do something innovative, but in return, you collect the data and you learn from the data. The regulator learns from the data as well. The FCA in the UK has been a big proponent of this as well. Hong Kong and also the Bank of Tanzania, as well as the Bank of Zambia, are very interested in utilizing this kind of regulatory sandbox. I think it's really useful because it's not just an opportunity for the company to provide interesting and innovative services, but it's also an opportunity for the regulators to learn about how consumers utilize those services, how they experience those services. And I think it helps the regulator as well understand what that total experience looks like. So I think they're very valuable.
I wanted to ask a little bit about these financial technologies. We have the snazzy shorthand of fintech. It's been showing up a lot more frequently now. I figure once Brookings has an event that has the snazzy nickname in the title, it's an idea that has arrived. Can you explain what you mean by financial technologies? It's obviously more than just, hey, I've got an app on my phone that'll let me access my bank. What are some of these different examples of financial technologies, and what are some of the newer, maybe more experimental or groundbreaking ones that are available?
I mean, one thing that has started to develop is, right now a lot of financial institutions use the credit score as a means to judge creditworthiness and the ability of people to repay loans. But for certain communities, that does not work very well because they have a low credit score, and so therefore they're kind of pushed outside financial services and don't have access to capital or money to start up businesses. So what some countries are doing, like China, for example, is doing this. They are evaluating credit from other types of information sources. So, for example, if through mobile payment systems you've demonstrated the ability to pay your bills, then they use that type of information to basically say, this person is a good customer. This person has a high probability of meeting commitments, repaying financial obligations. And so financial technology can provide other means of judging customers other than through a traditional credit score.
And if I could just add to that, so the digital credit space, which is what Daryl just described, is actually growing, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. So the kinds of information that companies would normally have used to underwrite are not available. But for instance, whether or not you get payments from friends through your mobile money account, whether you do pay your bills through that, those are all, again, information that are used to underwrite very, very small digital credit loans that are typically, you know, last for 2 weeks and you have to repay, et cetera. So, you know, I've seen a real increase in that product throughout sub-Saharan Africa. But in addition, there's also a product which is a kind of a life insurance product that has also been increasingly offered in the digital space. And so often what it is, it's added to a mobile money account, and there's a sort of free kind of life insurance product that's tacked on. And it's usually used in markets where the cell phone market is really, really competitive. And it's one of the ways in which the cell phone companies and mobile phone companies actually try to keep customers as they add these additional incentives. And so these life insurance products actually have turned out to be quite popular where they've been offered, and also burial insurance. So they're utilizing this digital space that are new and innovative, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa.
And I'd say the other application that has really taken off is mobile payment systems. So, for example, when I go to China, young people basically are now living in a cashless society. Like, they're doing everything through their phones. You know, they go to a restaurant and they use the phone to pay the bills. The companies have set up very easy user interfaces to encourage that. And so, ironically, that's an area where China is ahead of the United States. Mobile payment systems here exist. You have Apple Pay, you have Google Pay. There are a lot of the technology companies that have tried to encourage that. They haven't really taken off. It's like people here still use credit cards to pay their restaurant bill or to pay for movie tickets. But other countries have made greater progress and have made it easier for mobile payment systems to flourish. So I would anticipate in the next 5 years, the United States will move more in that direction just because consumers love the convenience of using their phone to pay bills.
I would agree with Daryl that certainly we are a little bit behind, I think, in the mobile payments space. And I think one of the reasons for that is that in the U.S., you have so many parties who are competing for business there. And the way the transactions work, you have so many people who will take revenue from the transaction from, you know, the initial point to the end. And so it becomes very, very difficult for anybody to make money. And so it's an interesting problem in the U.S. In other countries, often you have one company that owns the whole transaction from A to Z. And so there aren't that many takes out of the transaction. And that often helps move the evolution of the product ahead a lot more quickly.
Aren't there also concerns, at least I can only speak to here in D.C., Washington City paper, among others, has often written about, while there's a lot of convenience factor in going cashless, then there are certain advantages to it for some people, for people who are completely unbanked. If a business goes cashless, that's another way that now someone who is unbanked can't have access to that business's services and or goods. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So depending on the payments model, a lot of them utilize credit cards in the back, right? Mm-hmm. So what happens is you have to load your credit card number, and then when you utilize your phone at a point of sale, it's actually taking money from your credit card. So if you're unbanked and don't have access to a credit card, then you obviously are cut out of that. And that does make it difficult. I think, you know, the early movers in this area, Apple, et cetera, Google, you know, are not thinking about unbanked people as their customers. They're really thinking about, you know, the folks who really want, who are sort of the technology first users. And I think this is an area where we really need to explore what are the opportunities to serve a lower income market and what would that look like. And I think that's an area of innovation that could be really interesting.
While we're still on the technology point, I did want to ask, anytime that there's a technological component to a policy solution, very often there's a temptation, at least maybe among the general public, in some cases among the pundits, to sort of seize on that technological component as the solution. While we're talking about these different technological aspects of meeting these needs, what are the sort of really crucial non-technological underpinnings to addressing these questions?
Well, I think in line with what Camille was talking about, technology cannot solve a particular problem if there are larger social and economic problems that will make it difficult for certain sectors of society to take advantage of the technology. So, you know, we can't ignore issues of wealth inequities, income inequality, lack of access to credit cards, lack of access to bank accounts, because if you have mobile payment systems that are linked to the credit card, then that's an area in which the technology is not going to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. It's actually going to reinforce existing inequalities. So we do need to think about those broader social and economic factors that make it difficult for people to gain access to financial services.
Camille, I did also want to follow up with you on sort of a takeoff from that. You have written in some of your previous things about how existing government incentives to build savings, to increase access to wealth and increase access to financial inclusion, right now they're either more often focused at middle-income households and people, or if they are designed for the low-income people, they're not really advertised very well, or just the public education component isn't there. Can you talk a little bit about some of those challenges and what are the maybe the most promising policy proposals for trying to meet the needs of the underserved?
Sure. You know, I think that one of the things that is clear when you look at the U.S. system is that the kinds of incentives for building wealth that exist in the tax code are clearly meant for people who are homeowners and, you know, have access to 401ks and, you know, that sort of thing. And so that is, you know, that's a good portion of the American public. And so, of course, it's very, very useful. And that's how people in middle income really tend to build wealth. In lower-income households that don't have access to that, don't own a home, the tax system doesn't really help them. And so they are very much excluded from the wealth-building mechanisms that, you know, others utilize here. And, you know, there haven't been that many really successful proposals to get that moving. So typically, the way that that's handled here in the U.S. is you'll have nonprofits and government agencies as well that will try to help lower-income people save enough money to be able to own a home and therefore, you know, get into the system. But that's not realistic for everybody. Mm-hmm. And I think that that was one of the reasons that in the previous administration, there was a bit of a focus on how you build retirement accounts for people who do not have access to 401ks and you know, those kinds of retirement vehicles, retirement savings vehicles. And so MyRA was an example of the thinking around how you do that. Mm-hmm. Now, that program isn't going to move forward, but the problem still exists. And so I think it's going to be left to a variety of actors, both in the private sector as well as the public sector, to try to think through how do we offer those kinds of accounts for retirement savings and other savings that are not necessarily linked to, you know, mortgages, but will be very valuable for low-income families, both to utilize for emergency purposes, but also to build enough capital so they can use the kind of leverage that is so critical in this economy to building wealth and to economic mobility.
All right. So looking forward for the next iterations of this report, I realize this one is only just coming out and I'm already asking you to look forward. It seems like each year you're sort of looking at new components. So last year you included looking at particularly underserved populations like women and refugees and migrants. This year you're adding in sort of the cybersecurity component. What are some of the aspects you want to try and focus on going forward?
I mean, one area where we think there are tremendous opportunities is with refugees because, for example, a lot of multilateral aid organizations are wanting to move towards providing cash assistance mm-hmm. for people, but yet people who are fleeing their home countries and are in transit don't have access to traditional banks or traditional financial services. Mobile money is actually a great solution for those people. Many of those people actually do have cell phones, like they're using the cell phone to navigate the path from their home country into Europe. And so we feel that mobile money could be a way to really help refugees. So that's a project that we're interested in undertaking.
All right. I think we're sort of coming up on time. Do either of you have any last thoughts you want to leave our listeners with?
The key thing is financial inclusion is vital for sustainable development, mm-hmm. both in the developing world as well as in the United States. So it's really important that we take this issue seriously. The more progress that we can make on opening up financial services to a broader range of people, the more inclusive the economy is going to be, the greater the economic growth, the more small businesses that are going to be created, the greater opportunities for marginalized populations. So we think it's an important topic area, and we hope that there can be progress made on it.
Excellent. Well, Daryl, thanks to you and your colleagues for doing this work and making it available to everyone. Camille, thank you for adding your thoughts here today. I want to let our listeners know they can find the report if they go to brookings.edu/FDIP. That's F-D-I-P. And they can also find the both of you on Twitter at Dara West, D-A-R-R West, and at Camille Bousset. And as always, you can follow Intersections and the rest of the Brookings Podcast Network at Policy Podcasts. Thank you both very much for joining us.
Excellent.
Thank you.